Right, we just continue now while we're passing the box around. Any further questions, comments, general discussion, feel free, and try and keep them brief. So if you keep them brief, we get through more, we can always come back to you if you've got any other points to raise. You just put your hand up and we'll get down to you as well. So anybody first?
Yeah, just from an efficiency by cleansing, I say I agree with the speaker, and we try to sterilize in America, and it's not a long time. Winston Churchill was a Home Secretary in Britain. He was trying to find the feeble people, or 100,000 people they were counted at that time, who was to put them in a black concentration, otherwise they would be bad for the British race. Oh, the new book comes this year by Clive Ponting. He was a civil servant. If you remember the Falkland time, he was in prison about the Belgrano. There is a new book. And in America also, they tried. At that time, there wasn't any black people or immigrants at that time anyway, but he was trying to find out, because he didn't recognize the poverty, the low income. But what he said, it was, there are a lot of people, the low-minded people, so we have to put them in a separate place, or we have to encourage women and not to have children, otherwise our race would be in danger. That's quite a vivid example. Churchill was not a long time ago, that was the 1950s. So when it comes to the trade unions, also the trade unions are the tools of the capitalists. I have a reservation, and I don't. Although I support the working class in mass, but the trade unions are the most, more efficient to the ongoing of capitalism, to make more efficiency. People, if you see any kind of, they always do for their own union. There are so many non-unionized workers in Britain as well. So I don't regard, the trade unions are, the vehicle of the working class movement. That's my opinion. I'm not talking about the past now. So the most dangerous one is the one the speaker said about them, by cleansing, by purifying, the blood of the genetic. So that's the most dangerous. Still, they didn't, but the second, they call it psychology or psychiatrists. At the moment, they are doing now, but they wouldn't be covertly now. I mean, it's only secret anyway. So, they want to be more efficient, more highly qualified, very few people. That's what they're trying to do. This is a kind of efficient. I think as a socialist, we have to find out this kind of things also. We shouldn't know about that one.
Just a very brief point to come back to that in relation to the eugenics thing. Of course, it's worth just saying that I mentioned the Fabian support for eugenics. There is this myth, there has been this myth traditionally on the left, which says that the alternative to capitalism, to the exploitation of a majority by a minority of private individuals, is in fact the state to step in and take control of society. And it's perhaps the myth of the left, in fact, the key myth of the left, which the Socialist Party not endorse, but not support at all. As far as we're concerned, the alternative to private capitalism is not state capitalism, but is in fact democratic control of society by the community as a whole. And there's quite an important difference between these things. But it's one of the pitfalls of supporting statism, which the left has traditionally done, is of course this. Where do you draw the line? If you are going to have a big, powerful bureaucracy, which a state almost inevitably becomes, taking the place, if you like, of private capitalists and organising things, then it's a very powerful boss indeed to have it over you, as people in places like Russia and China have found their cost during this century. And this eugenics thing was an example of that, because some of the people supporting it regarded themselves as quite progressive, quite radical, and even as socialists. And what they were saying is, look, we've got a social problem, we've got people who are impoverished, who are somehow irresponsible, who are not looking after themselves properly. It's their fault, basically, it's not the fault of the system, so the argument went. And therefore, our solution is quite genuine and quite positive. We'll use this intervention of the state, not, for example, to pay better wages or what have you, but to actually control the population literally, to decide who will live and what kind of families will be allowed to have progeny and which won't. And it's worth saying, again, out of fairness to them, if you like, that at the time, they acted in good faith, they held these views sincerely. They say there's always a danger of one generation simply mocking a previous generation. At the time, this was an idea. As I said earlier, and I think it's an important point, the people we should reserve our real vituperation for are not those from a previous generation who made sad and tragic mistakes of this kind, but those of the present generation who are able to look at this history and repeat the mistakes of history. Those are the people who, if any, should be condemned. Certainly the actions should be condemned.
We're talking about Churchill being a liberal reforms. I don't know if he was a liberal or conservative, but he set up the wage councils. But I mean, that was a sop to keep the workers happy. Why the present government of this period after trying to deregulate it? And also, I mean, if you're working under an industry that's covered by the wage council, you're getting very low wages indeed. And another point I want to add about it goes a bit beyond 1914. I think maybe it's people from the north can give a fuller story than I can about it. The nationalisation by the wartime government, the First World War, the Carlisle Brewery, because the people were making arms and they were sort of spending more time in the pubs than they were making arms. The only way they could get an efficiency in producing arms was to nationalise the pubs in Carlisle and make sure so they could regulate the hours. And they weren't deregulated until about under the Heath government.
Back there, please. Yeah.
Yes, can you explain why the Chris Carse, having introduced these reforms which they deem necessary for their own survival and for alleged greater efficiency, have in the last 12 years of Thatcherism started to withdraw them and demolish the welfare state?
Yes, I think it's a good question, but there have always been different tendencies within the capitalist class. As I said, even then, there was one group of employers which said, no, we can't afford this. And that, in a sense, is the key to the answer. Because when I forget the precise name, the Employers Parliamentary Association, I think, in 1911, formed an organisation against the National Insurance Scheme because they couldn't afford it. They were doing so as a smaller capitalist. The answer to your question is that in a period of recession, and even in a long period of relative decline, arguably, it's a question, A, of capitalists generally saying we can't afford it, and therefore we're going to have to force workers into a greater state of degeneration, whatever the long-term cost. It's a kind of a short-term attitude, if you like.
They're prepared to take that risk.
They feel that they cannot choose but take that risk because of the short-term exigencies of the system and because of the short-term pressures of competition with other nations. So there is this cutthroat competition going on between nations. Policy is not always decided rationally or over a very long period, far from it. So partly it's a question of that. And partly, of course, there is the other aspect, which is not just a question of them saying, look, it's a recession now, so therefore things have to change. There's also changing ideas and ideologies. And it's possible to, as I've suggested, the idea of a welfare state was clearly born at the turn of the century, not at the time of the Second World War at all. It was simply refined then and extended and done in the name of labour rather than in the name of capitalism. Then we've got an idea which was developed around the turn of the century, which was partly put into action 10, 20 years later. Then we saw a period of relative depression in the 20s and 30s, when there was no great change and no great extension to that system, possibly because of that period of relative economic crisis. Then we have the Second World War, which of course, once again, produced after the war much greater expectations, because workers had been told, go out there and slaughter one another and your reward will be not just in heaven if you die, but as you come back, we'll have homes for heroes and so on, and provision of good health. So, in a sense, in order to persuade workers to fight yet another world war, there had to be some bribery. After the Second World War, we had once again a period of relative economic growth, partly because of the rebuilding of industry after the war, partly because of the development of the trade cycle. So, for all of those reasons, the post-Second World War period was far more opportune for a further extension of that system than it had been, say, in the 1920s and 30s, the time of the Wall Street crash. So, a lot of these changes do have fairly obvious economic reasons, it could be argued. Then there was a relatively long period of growth, almost unprecedented, in the post-war years, going right up to the 70s, around the time of the oil crisis, and the crisis of overproduction in steel and shipbuilding and the car industries in the 1970s in Britain. But around that time, we also have a new factor, which is a change in ideology. The whole concept of monetarism, the decade of the Thatcher government, which had a very doctrinaire approach to some of these issues, And we can't rule out, in other words, the idea of the capitalist class in a certain place, in a certain time, having certain ideas and developing certain policies. It looks very much now as though, at the turn of the century, the capitalists possibly felt they had a very long-term, enlightened view of their own interests, and maybe they did have. But certainly the present generation of capitalists don't have that view, for right or for wrong. Whether it's in their own interests or not is not our problem. But the present orthodoxy, I would say, of the modern capitalist class in most parts of the world, and particularly here in Britain, is to say, no, it went too far as a notion in terms of their interests. And therefore there obviously is a great cutting back in that sense. But clearly most people around at that time would not have been around just over a century earlier. One or two of them may have had parents who remembered the revolutionary upheavals of the mid-19th century, I suppose. And one or two of them may even have known a little about what happened at the time of the Paris Commune. But for all that, most Europeans, let's say, hearing about the Russian Revolution, would clearly, once the news started to filter through, have been extremely excited. And people who regarded themselves as being socialists of one kind or another clearly would have to be extremely interested in the fact that here was a vast social upheaval involving literally millions of people. And it was basically in the name of socialism, and indeed in the name of Marx in particular. The Socialist Party, as it happens, was unique in not, in the years following the Russian Revolution, being taken in by the claim, which so many were taken in by, that this was it, this was the new paradise, and that this was a new land of freedom and democracy and peace. The vast majority of people, I would say, who had called themselves socialists or communists, rallied to the call and thought this is it. The great Lenin and the great Bolsheviks have won the day. The Socialist Party was actually completely unique in not, in fact, jumping to that conclusion, looking at the situation rather more carefully and accurately, and realising that for genuine socialism to develop across the world, there has to first be the right conditions. And those conditions basically are, on the one hand, material. There has to be a proper material base for producing wealth internationally to satisfy the needs of humanity. But perhaps even more important, perhaps more significantly, there is a need for working-class consciousness, for a vast majority of people who understand what socialism is all about, who want it, who are prepared to support it democratically. And some of these conditions were clearly anything but present in Russia, quite the opposite, in fact. It's simply not the case that the majority of people in Russia in 1917 wanted socialism, or even knew what it properly was. And this is where the problems, of course, began. Now, it's a question which doesn't relate directly to today's subject. Nevertheless, we can discuss it, although I don't want to go on, obviously, too long, because others may wish to contribute. But I think the questioner is absolutely right when he implies that in the longer term, the Russian Revolution, far from being the arrival of socialism, proved to be something of a setback to the socialist movement. Because as the new regime in Russia took shape, and as it proceeded on its rather bloody path of oppression, because any group coming into power in a capitalist environment, which is what it was, has to be ruthless in order to maintain power, particularly when they have the support of a minority in the long term. You had all the conditions there for the most brutal of dictatorships, and sure enough, that's exactly what developed. And yet it did it in the name of socialism. And the reason, I assume, that the questioner refers to this as a setback in the movement for socialism is precisely that for many, many years, those of us who are committed to genuine democratic socialism, when trying to put across the ideas for abolishing the market system, when trying to persuade people that the only possible way forward is in fact to produce wealth directly for human needs, have frequently been told over the years, many, many times, that's what Russia was all about, and it's very dictatorial, very nasty indeed. And of course we've had to spend an enormous amount of effort, an enormous amount of time, actually explaining to people painstakingly the clear difference in situation, the difference in condition, the fact that the Russian Revolution may have been executed in the name of socialism, but in fact bore very little resemblance to the basic Marxist principles of democratic change and democratic organisation, which we adhere to. So in that sense, of course, it's a confusion. And people on the left who have paid lip service to various regimes around the world do a disservice to the idea of socialism, because we have to in fact stress to people, without any confusion, that the world is capitalist at present. It's clearly capitalist. And of course, we've been very vindicated in this, in the sense that recent years have seen a situation where even states like Russia, which for a long time paid lip service to socialism, they've even given up paying lip service. And now it's therefore clearer than ever before that you've got one world, not two or three. You haven't got a third world or a communist world or any of these things. You've just got one world, one globe, and it's organised according to one social system, Of course, there are regional differences, cultural differences. In some parts of the world, you have more state intervention. In other parts of the world, you have more free market practice. But nevertheless, you basically have an economic marketplace system in every country in the world. You have done for some many decades, indeed centuries. And this is the system we've got to get rid of. So there you are. My answer to the question is yes, the Russian Revolution, whilst having exciting and being a great interest to look at, to analyse and to learn from, in fact, in the longer term, has proven to be something of a setback, something of a diversion, to put it mildly, from the true course towards genuine socialism.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a theory going around that the welfare state is a sort of aberration as far as capitalism is concerned. It was introduced, you know, after the war, extended up after the war, the peculiar historical circumstances to that time, as you say, to try and bribe workers to, you know, to support the war. But the normal situation of capitalism is where you don't have it. And the theory is that we're now going back to this situation. If you look at America, this is what has begun to happen. You know, there are no public houses, hospitals. And people have to fend themselves, and TB and all these infectious diseases are coming back. I mean, it's maybe an exaggeration because we're in an economic crisis, and obviously whatever the government spends has to come out of the profit-making sector of the economy. If the profit-making sector is not making profits, then they're going to have to come back. And what do you think of this general theory that the welfare state is a sort of aberration, which is a bit contemporary?
Ideas differ as to when capitalism began, obviously, and the beginning of capitalism was itself a somewhat gradual process in many ways, perhaps more so than the beginning of socialism would. The arrival of capitalism as such can be dated to various times, certainly not to one precise year, but let's say for argument's sake, particularly in the European context, that if we were to date the onset of capitalism from, say, the 17th century, 16th century, which I think would probably a lot of people would go along with, perhaps, we're talking about several hundred years of capitalism, basically. And within that period, the welfare state, so to speak, has existed clearly for a fairly small minority of that time. I mean, the measures I referred to earlier on this afternoon, just before the First World War, were very limited. Although I said it at the beginning of the welfare state, they were not as comprehensive as those introduced after the war. So I'm not sure if we could even include those. We could say just the very beginnings of a welfare state just before the First World War, which itself, after all, was only 80 years ago. So you could say that for the very most, we've had less than a century of this. So I suppose to that extent, you could say, is it an aberration? Are we going to return to the previous situation? I think possibly we are, to some extent, because after all, there was nothing inherently within capitalism in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries which prohibited the existence of such measures. It's not something which specifically has to be seen as a modern development. It's actually something which has grown up now and can indeed, you know, you can conceive of modern capitalism without these particular measures. Now, you mentioned America. Of course, it's not quite that simple, because although in the United States they don't have the kind of state provision which exists in this country and in other European countries, of course, what they do have in the United States is fairly widespread insurance systems, private insurance schemes, which by no means all workers, but a number of workers subscribe to. That itself is a fairly modern development. The existence of private social insurance schemes, which a number of workers in America subscribe to, is itself something which clearly didn't exist in earlier centuries, not in such a form, not in such a widespread form. So that indeed may be another possible form. I would just draw your attention to one anomaly, however. There are many other countries in Europe, aside from Britain, which are worth paying attention to, because although one or two countries, I believe, have had cutbacks to their social provisions, there are nevertheless other European countries, and maybe there are people present who can enlighten us more on this, because I certainly don't know the details, and maybe people here who do. But I'm under the impression that if you take Europe as a whole, the picture is not quite so simple. In other words, there are some European countries which have cut back on this in recent years, but I do believe that there are certainly one or two countries in Europe which have not, by any means, cut back on their social provision schemes and their state insurance schemes. And indeed, some of these schemes, I think, have been far more generous than that in Britain. And I'm putting it bluntly, the dole in Germany is a hell of a lot more than the dole in Britain. This is a fact. So this, in fact, has to be accounted for not just by looking at one country. If you're talking about changing trends and aberrations in capitalism, we'd have to presumably look at a more worldwide, or at least a European context. But perhaps I can throw the question back and ask the questioner what he thinks is the case. Can I do that?
Well, I mean,
I don't know.
You see, obviously, as you pointed out, the capitalist class has got a choice. They've got to do something about people in poor people, otherwise there'll be an increase in what you said at the beginning, an increase in crime and violence and rioting. And I think the actual level which they fixed was the so-called benefits that they pay to people. They judge it finely. This must be the level, if they go too low, people will riot. If they go too high, they're spending too much money. So the level, if you like, is a political level. You can see if they overstep the mark, like they did at the time of the poll tax.